The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 286 for Wednesday, the 17th of August, 2011. My name is Martin Darlington, for those who can remember, and I'm finally back and very happy to be so. With me across the Atlantic in California is Jules Cheesek. How are you doing, Jules?
Good, good. Martin, welcome back from the dead.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. It's good to be back. I can truly say that, and particularly with such a fantastic weekend of racing to report.
Yeah, we really missed you, Martin. It's good to have the British voice on the show to give us some credibility.
That's stretching it a bit. Yeah, we'll see if we can nick it, slip in a Neil Spaulding.
You know, speaking of which, did you notice that the Eurosport guys stole your little routine? Toby Moody was doing a Spalding impersonation this weekend.
I missed that bit.
Yeah, I believe it was at Laguna. It was at the Laguna round. He did it at Laguna.
Right.
Yep.
So he's trying
to steal your thunder there.
And anyone who follows Neil Spalding on Twitter will realize that, along with a couple of other recent journalist Twitterers, his account was hacked.
Oh,
and
yeah.
There was a brilliant tweet, and it said it was one of those, check this out, only just started and I've earned $400 already. And there's obviously a link, and it's a spam thing, and everyone knows it's a spam thing, so everyone started tweeting him. And he sent back going, thanks for bringing my attention to it, passwords reset. Now, anyone know where I can pick up this $400 I've apparently earned? Which
nice.
I think is a nice touch, yeah.
Yep.
But, Braxy was another one who got hijacked.
Yeah, and Paolo Scalera from GP1.
Oh, right, well. Yeah. And old friend of the show, Guy Anderson, and sometime co-host. And he said, I got a direct message from him saying, hey, these weight loss pills really work.
Really?
What are you trying to say, dude?
Nice.
Yeah, and Elena Myers. Elena Myers' account got hacked.
Well, did they all have the same password or something?
I don't know.
Like,
no, I know.
Go fast, like, or password or something?
Yeah. 0000. Yeah, I've just given mine away.
Right. Well, anyway, just be careful out there. You know, you don't know where that Twitter's been.
No.
So, first I got to do a little bit of errata. Richard Dort, who's a extremely knowledgeable electric racing guy, I mean, fan, and writes a lot about it, and he's been a fan of the show for a long time. Kind of called me out on some bullshit that I basically was pulling out of my ass last week. He said top speeds for e-bikes were 215 kilometers per hour for the Mission and 217 for the Lightning, which is about 135, not 160, which is what I was saying they were hitting. I mean, I was still thinking about the Isle of Man TT, where the Chish bikes hit almost 160 miles an hour. And then he also said that Rapp's qualifying time on the Mission would have put him fifth on the Supersport grid and 20th in the Daytona Superbikes class. And he said, tisk, tisk, Jules. Yeah, well, you know, I was just excited, okay?
It's artistic license.
Yeah, there you go.
Lies, damn lies, statistics.
Right, exactly. Sorry. Good quote. Adrian Rozinski wrote in last week. I was talking about the story about Team Electra's bike going up to Sebastopol for a quick fix, and so he wrote in with some more details about that because he was involved with that a bit. He said Brian Hall of Thunderstruck Motors was the guy in Sebastopol that the bike got sent to. He has been involved in electric racing for years, as well as conversions. He worked with Team Vault at the 2010 Infineon TTX race. And Brian does not build motors, but he had an AC motor in stock that was the same make as Electra's original motor and had the expertise to make it work. That was from AJ. Thanks, AJ, for the detail. And I hope you didn't lose your helmet, buddy. That's a little insider.
I was going to say.
Yeah, we were messing with AJ during the weekend. At Fion a few months ago, he accidentally put his helmet down inside of some van, and they drove away with it.
Cool.
And so you know, since then his helm has been disappearing to various jokers hanging around.
He hasn't had postcards sent from it, has it?
Ooh, now there's an idea. There's an idea.
Oh yeah, no, that was a favourite thing that soldiers used to do. Is someone would have a prized possession nicked, and then they'd receive postcards or photographs from all over the world with the photograph of the mascot or the, you know, helmet or the piece of equipment they'd lost, with, you know, Sydney Harbour Bridge in the background, and next one would have, you know, the Empire State Building.
Right. Or the travelling gnome.
Not that I would encourage any of our listeners to indulge in such childish pranks.
Oh, AJ. We got an interesting email also from Mike Moynihan. Who writes, Jim talked about the electric bikes one day making similar lap times as MotoGP. While I am excited and a fan of e-bikes, it got me thinking. MotoGP bikes' fuel capacity each year is getting smaller, but the electric charge held in the e-bikes' batteries each year is increasing. Is there going to be a point where electric bikes will have an advantage due to increasing energy capacity of batteries, and the gasoline bikes are handicapped due to decreasing fuel capacities, that by attrition the e-bikes will catch up? My real question, and hence the intended pun in the title, is how many joules, of energy are stored in 21 liters? Is that the current limit? That is the current limit in a MotoGP bike compared to the joules of energy in the batteries of current bikes. So I did a very quick calculation just before the show, and 21 liters of gasoline. Now, the thing is, there's many different types of gasoline, which the efficiency of the burn is what really matters. But the amount of energy in 21 liters is, I believe, 201 kilowatts, the equivalent of 201 kilowatts. So I don't know. I'm not going to convert that into joules. But the electric bikes, the open class bikes, I do not know the exact data. Maybe somebody out there knows. But it sounds like 201 kilowatts is not that far away, because they have a lower class, which is 75 kilowatt. That's about 30-something percent of the MotoGP bike's gas tank. That's already pretty substantial, and that's the class that's limited in the battery capacity. So I'm guessing that the Chish bike, for example, at the Isle of Man TT, had quite a bit of energy, which it's just – this. You know what? This sounds wrong. There's something wrong here, because I must be off by like an entire
a killer or order, omega
order of magnitude, because
I know I'm thinking it for it,
because there's no way, because the thing is, electric motors are much more efficient than gasoline motors. So I mean, a gasoline motor only uses about 30% of the energy that it burns, although I'm sure the MotoGP bikes have slightly higher than that, maybe like let's say closer to 40%. Whereas an electric bike uses like something over 70% of the electricity goes to the actual rotation of the motor, and only like 30% gets wasted in heat. So 201 kilowatts, there's got to be something wrong. Anyways, if somebody actually knows the real numbers, email us. We'll correct it next show. But it is very interesting, right? Okay, and then Mike also wrote on a side note, he wrote, Jules, with your comment about Yamaha pulling out of World Superbikes, would like to point out that Honda has been running a non-factory effort ever since the Flamini brothers standoff with their non-factory supported rules changes to save the series. I know it was implied with only Suzuki, BMW, and Kawasaki being the only factory efforts next year, but Tenkate has been the sole Honda effort for a very long time. This is true. But again, it's one of those, you know, quote privateer teams. I think they were receiving some serious factory support for quite a few seasons, like with when Tozen was on it.
Yeah,
those years.
More like Alfea Ducati this year.
Yes, exactly, exactly. Which I think, you know, it's fine. I think that's fine. I think I like I said last week, I kind of would like to see Superbikes go into this, back into this, its roots with mostly privateerish teams. Sure, they will have factory backing because the factory's not going to just sit back and let another factory take the spoils. Somebody's going to do a little bit of help, right? So then that means they're all going to do it.
Well, of course, we've also got this situation where the company that owns Dorna is one of the companies bidding to buy World Superbikes.
Yeah, that's right.
Rights to World Superbikes. Michael Scott in GP Week, I think last week or maybe the week before, did his editorial bit talking about the possibly inevitable merging of the two series. And you think, with all this stuff about CRT bikes, we'll come on to that about the Brno test later, which are getting closer, you think, well, actually, I mean, I wonder how, I suspect a World Superbike bike would be closer to the MotoGP bikes around somewhere like Brno than the CRT bikes are at the moment. You know, it's a possibility, and I do sometimes think they split the audience between them when, if they could cooperate a bit more, which obviously they won't do because they hate each other, you know, they could ensure, but if it was all one series, you know, mind you, well, I suppose all that might happen is we end up halving the amount of watchable bike racing on telly. I can't see them going to extra rounds.
It's also confusing, right? Because the two series have been kind of at each other's throats, but like legally constantly putting themselves. I mean, they're both sanctioned by the FIM, right? But
yeah.
But the promotion is done by two totally kind of, you know, polar opposite groups. They don't want anything to do with each other, and all of a sudden, you know, they're gonna be. It would be really weird if they were under the same umbrella. But it might solve a lot of problems, you know.
Yeah, no, definitely.
I would love to, for example, be able to see not just the rider, but the bike from one series be able to jump into the other. You know, like, imagine, like, Carlos Checa wins the World Superbike Championship and then takes that team gets to go to MotoGP, you know, as a CRT team or something, you know. Be interesting.
Or he wildcards at Valencia, but on the Altair Ducati.
Yeah. I mean, you know.
No, I'm not sure Ducati would like that because there's a very good chance that he wouldn't be the slowest Ducati.
Oh, mind man, you, that's harsh.
Heck of an advert for his for their road bikes.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's no way they could really compete with a true MotoGP machine. But if they were given, you know, like a green light to. Automatically a green light to be a CRT team with, I don't know, some bending of the rules to allow them to, I don't know, bore the sucker out. I don't know.
Yeah.
Totally, you know, just, it'd be an interesting situation. Anyway.
Yep.
Right.
We also had an email leading up to Brno from Steve Schmidt, old friend of the show. I met Stephen at Silverstone this year. He's American living in London and has a fascinating job. He works for an independent brewery, so he's a good guy to meet up and talk about beer with.
which doesn't surprise me that that's why he was at Brno.
No, the home of Pilsner. And but Steve, he sent an email, and unfortunately it all happened too late for us to get it into last week's show. But Jules and Jim sent out bits and pieces on, you know, email and Twitter just to let people know that Stephen was there and interested in a meetup. And so I believe you've got an idea for anyone in the future who wants to do meetups.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have to. I mean, we're not at every round. We're actually only attending maybe four or five rounds a year as a team. I mean, individually as a whole, and but if there's listeners who are going to a certain round, just tell us. Write an email to meetup@motopodcast.com, and if we get more than one, we'll make sure we hook you guys up. You know, you can meet some other listeners. It's always fun to run into people you don't you've never met, but share, you know, something common with at a racetrack like that. It's fun. I tried to meet up with Alan Fleming at Brno last year, and just didn't work out. It was a real shame. That's a tough circuit to run around and do. You know, if you don't know exactly where you're going, it's a big ass track.
Yeah, yeah.
And finally,
the German bikers coming out of the woods, and it's like, ooh, scary.
Yeah. So, and then finally, we got a great email from Colin Fetwell from everything about electric motorcycles, ice bikes, and radio control airplanes. Thank you very much for that email. It was fun. We'll reply to you in email. And now let's move on, because we had a really, really good race weekend at Brno.
We did. We'll go through in the order the races happened. So we had 125s, and Nico Tirol got pole position again with becoming his shadow, Johann Zarco, second, Sandro Cortese, third. Second row was Valbel, Salomon, Vasquez. And the third row was Danny Kent, having a great weekend up to that point.
Yep.
Moncoya and Vinales. Now, Jonas Folger.
Not only was Tirol in pole, though, he was pretty much dominating from the moment that he showed up. The moment he got on the bike, he was dominating.
It was a classic Tirol weekend, a la the beginning of the season. Just worth mentioning with Danny Kent, there was one of the practices that was wet, and he was third. A couple of other practices, he was fourth and fifth. Now, he was riding Jonas Folger's Aprilia RSA rather than his sort of three-year-old incarnation of the same bike. And, wow, what a difference. Folger was poorly and was basically sent home to recuperate. He had a virus. So he didn't.
He didn't take that part.
Yeah. So that was the front three rows, and when the lights went out, Tirol immediately. I mean, he pulled out probably a second within about three or four corners, but then was closed down.
It looked like he was going to get away, but that wasn't to be, because we had both Cortese and Zarco stick with him, and they started to gap the other riders almost right away, because by the end of the first lap there was already about a second between Zarco and actually Cortese at that point, and I forget who was at fourth at that point, but actually no, Fobel was also with them for a while. He was with them for a while.
And we had quite a decent group forming in second place. In fact, at one point, it was six, seven riders. Moncoya, Fobel, Gadea, Vinales, Kent was in there. And I think Efren Vasquez was in that group as well.
Correct.
And they were duffing each other up, probably not helping closing down the runaway leads.
No.
And then on lap, something reasonably early, it was about five or six, Tirol was just seen to pull over, and he had a mechanical DNF. So not great for Aspar. No, there's been no news on what exactly it was, but he was out of the show, which did make for an interesting race, because then we had Cortese and Zarco just having a fantastic stalking, now I got you. And the other guy would go, stalking, now I got you. And that went on right to the end. And Cortese pipped it. So neither of them, particularly Cortese, surprised me, neither of them have ever won a race before.
Yeah, I mean, Cortese's been a staple of the 125 class since I can remember.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, for 125, he's an old man. He's in his 20s. So Zarco's still without a win, beaten by just shy of 0.4 of a second. But, you know, brilliant race. But behind them, it's just, I mean, because they were close together, we looked at them quite a lot, but the cameras couldn't resist going back to the Moncoya, Fobel, Gadea, Vinales. Vasquez crashed out. And Danny Kent crashed out. So we ended up with this five-rider four rider at the end. Punch
total
up
mashup. Which, it was amazing.
Yeah.
Moncayo and Phil Bell were like 4/100ths apart at the finish.
Yeah. And then it was interesting. We've seen this before with the following group, with Vinales entering the last lap, leading it and finishing it at the back. And I can't remember which race it was. I'm sure someone will be able to remind us. But it was Moncayo came third. And I'm not sure if that's his first podium, but it's certainly a rare one. Falbel fourth, Gadea fifth, and Vinales sixth. And then you've got to go another 13 plus seconds back before you get to Jakub Kornfael, who was the Czechoslovakian chap who came in seventh. Grotzky, Kai Rudin, Jasper Iwema, Luigi Morciano was 11th, Danny Webb 12th. Harry Stafford, after an appalling run of luck this year, finally scored some points.
Uh-huh.
Coming in 13th, Marcel Schotter 14th, and Lewis Rossi 15th. So, really set the scene, that did, and I thought that's a cracking good race to start the day. And amazingly, for a weekend in the summer, I was at work. We didn't get a single shout till after MotoGP finished, so I was chuffed a bit. And what it has done, Nico Tirol's lead hasn't evaporated, but it's now 12 points with Zarco behind him. And Zarco is creating a level of consistency that's got to have Tirol looking over his shoulder. And, God, this is a brilliant point that Jules has popped in the notes here.
Emilio Alzamora won the 125 championship, scoring 5 seconds, 5/3, and no wins. But he had only one DNF, and he beat out Melandri, who had won 5 times but had a bunch of DNFs. And I think he actually was injured at the beginning of the season because he had not... When I was looking at the grid positions, he was not registered for the first 3 or 4 races.
Right.
So I think he started the season hurt or something. Anyway, so he had a bunch of did not start. So this should be a warning to Tirol, because despite the fact that Zarco still has not won, which is just, it seems like a matter of time, but, you know, it just keeps slipping away.
Yeah.
He's only 12 points behind him. This is the series that, you know, after 3 rounds, we were like, oh, Jesus, what a runaway, because it was like win, win, win.
Yeah.
And the other guys that were behind him were all, you know, different every single round. So just all of a sudden, he had a tremendous lead, you know, and we were like,
yeah. It's strange. We've talked about this before. If you're going to have a good half and a bad half of the season, for goodness sake, have the bad half first. Because then people notice how well you've improved. And, you know, to have a lead and have it eaten away is... I mean, we saw it with Bayliss. And, of course, he lost to Colin Edwards in 02.
02, I think, yeah.
Yeah. We saw it with Toseland in the 07 World Superbike Championship as well. And he held on and just pipped Hager by the 2 points. But it just leaves a... sort of feeling when you see someone who had such a lead. And now, and the pressure must be enormous. So we've got Tirol on 166 points, 12 points behind him is Zarco on 154, 22 behind him. So still within a race win is Vinales on 132, with Cortese right on his heels at 131. So, yeah, it was...
The result, I mean, the race was good, and the championship is hot. So this is a really good one to watch, definitely.
That
all three championships are close and enough in points that they're all fascinating in their own ways.
Yeah, no, definitely. And then we had Moto2, and wow, did this ever live up to its billing?
Yeah.
If anyone hasn't seen these races, I particularly if you can only watch one race this week, watch the Moto2.
It was definitely the best Moto2 race because it didn't feel random for once. Like last year's races, there were some good races last year, definitely. I'm not saying they were bad races, but they seemed like every week it was somebody else out there. This was the same get people kind of, you know, with one exception maybe. And And it was a freaking good race. But go ahead. Let's go through QP first.
So QP, we had Marc Marquez, yet another pole position with Bradle.
How many does he have now?
I'm starting to think it might be most of them.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking too.
Off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you, but we had Marquez, Bradle, De Angelis on the front row, Tom Luthy, Crazy Joe Iannone, Andrea Iannone, and Aleth Espargaró, row two, Simone Corsi, Mattia Pessini, and Claudio Corti, row three. So all known names, all people who have run at near or at the front with a very good showing from the older Espargaró. The race got underway, and bloody hell, I mean, nobody could make a break. Again, at one point, it looked like Bradle was going to do a classic, get the whole shot, disappear, but he got hauled back in, and it just went on and on and on with what ended up with a group of five at the front, with Iannone, Marquez, Bradle, De Angelis, and Luthy, basically pulling away, but again, not hugely. Brad Smith was in that group for a while, and he very, very nearly got taken out.
Who was somebody crashed right in front of him that was...
Yes, I'm trying to think who it was now. Was it Max Neukirchner?
No,
Kirchner went down.
Neukirchner did crash, but that was earlier, or alone. But, damn, it sucks.
I'm just looking at the DNFs. Jules Clouzel.
Oh, Clouzel. Yes, absolutely. Jules Clouzel.
Jules Clouzel crashed. Bradley got knocked back, again, having to avoid someone else's crash, and very nearly. I mean, it looked the initial shot. There's no way he could have avoided him, but he did. I'm not sure if he got hit, but again, I think with the added pressure trying to catch up, Bradley then crashed out. And unlike Charlie Cox doing his wrap-up, it wasn't Bradley's bike we saw cartwheeling. That was somebody else. I'm not sure who it was, but it was either Lorenzetti, Baldellini, Morales, Yoni Hernandez, or Randy Krumenacker. Now, one thing we did find at the start of the race was we didn't have Julian Simon. He had run in free practice. He didn't run in qualifying, and the team decided after his aggravated injury from last time out, he wasn't going to compete. So we did have a gap, and everybody moved up a place to make up for that. What was interesting was, I thought particularly, was Iannone. You know, we all know what he's like, very aggressive. He's been nowhere since his win at the beginning of the season. It was actually quite fascinating because when you think about it, this was the third Italian podium in all classes all year.
Oh, my God.
One of the other ones was Iannone. We had Rossi came third at the MotoGP round in...
Le Mans?
Yes. I'm going to say yes and hope that you're right, because then it looks like I know what I'm talking about.
So we're so bad, Iannone, dude.
But this is incredible. The Italians, I mean, if anybody wants to look up who's been the most successful motorcycle racing nation at MotoGP, or, you know, at the prototype top world level over the years, Spain have recently, I think last year Spain overtook Britain because we had so many good races in the 50s and 60s, and then I was born, don't know what happened there. But the Italians are streets ahead of everybody else, absolutely. You know, they've dominated it for decades. They've always had somebody there or thereabouts, and yet in all three classes, more than halfway through the season, that's the third Italian podium. And in case anyone didn't know, there would be a fourth before the weekend was over, but we'll come to that.
Right.
Fourth and a fifth. That blew me away. But Iannone won the race with, and I was waiting for his tyres to go off. And the Eurosport guys were saying that during the break, there'd been things said that he basically, Andrea Iannone was told by his team bosses, look, you know, we know you've got the capability, but we just don't think at the moment you've got the motivation. Go away, think about what you want to do, come back. Well, whatever he's decided he wanted to do, obviously it was run at the front of Moto2, because he was awesome. So was DeAngelis. Marquez put some really tough but good moves on people.
Well, him and Dean, DeAngelis definitely were roughing each other up. But there was some beautiful, you know, like little gesturing going on as they're heading down the hill from turn five.
Yeah. And there was a lot of people looking at each other.
Yeah, like and even taking their hands off the bars and still maintaining with that lead. You know, I mean, those guys fought to the very end. It was extremely entertaining.
Tom Luthie pretty much stayed at the back of that group from about third race distance. Tom Luthie stayed fifth, and by the end, he dropped 4 seconds off. But it was really
at the end that, you know, he was up there with them.
Yeah, but he never pushed himself.
No.
I don't think he ever got right up to the pointy end. But Bradle is just, he's unflappable. And
he's got some serious racecraft. That's the guy. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely skill all around. And Marquez has innate ability on the motorcycle. It's amazing what that guy can pull off. But it always seems like, you know, he's pulling off miracles. Whereas Bradle, I don't think he makes it look easy, but he's very calculating. He's a very smart rider, which actually kind of, I guess, fits their...
I know what you mean.
Their,
it
nationalities,
like,
you know, the hot, you know, hot-blooded Spaniard versus the calculating German. You know, I guess.
I know what you mean. He doesn't make it look easy, but everything he does, you think he's known for a while. That's what he was going to do.
Yes. His plan.
Because Marquez is sort of like, oh, something's up, and reacts brilliantly. But yeah, and we might be doing them both a disservice, but. But that was the other interesting, that leading group, five different nationalities. You've got an Italian, a Spaniard, a German, San Marino with DeAngelis, and a Swiss with Tom Luthie, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, I like it.
Ian only won from Marquez, from Bradle. So,
and Ian only made a big, give Bradle a big gift there because Marquez could have won that one. He really could have won that one. And that would have been 9 points instead of four.
But, the reactions from all of them as they crossed the line was, I mean, Ian Oni was absolutely ecstatic.
Yes.
Marquez was, by the end of the warm down lap, was waving and could look quite happy, but I think was a bit... And Bradle was just like, yep, job done. Thank you very much. 43-point lead in the championship still, which could have been, 38?
Yep.
Onwards and upwards. DeAngelis, it was a shame he didn't finish on the podium. Because I do like seeing DeAngelis now. He seems to have stopped being the uncontrollable missile and...
I mean, he still seems kind of nutty out there. He definitely, out of those four guys, he seemed the least in control. And especially given that Iannone was in there, who's, you know, Crazy Joe. But even he looked much more, he did put on some hard moves. But Dean, I mean, DeAngelis is like two races in a row now. Last time I went, they were in Silverstone. And now this time, at the Sachsenring he was very, very much up there at the pointy end and doing damage. he's still wild. I guess he just isn't crashing as much.
We're watching him in a series and at the same time as we're seeing Jules Cluzel, so maybe he just looks less wild in comparison to the crazy Frenchman.
There you go.
Crazy sideways Frenchman in the gravel. Where we heard that before. Mm-hmm. So we've got Bradle on 183, 43 points behind. So he is maintaining a gap, although it is closing from what it has been. Marquez, DeAngelis on 95. Then we've got Iannone and Corsi tied on 91 with Tom Luthie on 88, Brad Smith 79. Yuki Takahashi, now his season's dropped off. He's down on 62.
Which is exactly what happened to him last year, too. Last year he started off fairly hot and then cooled off, you know, and then he had a couple of moments where he shined, but Maybe this is a series of races where he just doesn't like the track.
That's a possibility, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and Julian Simon on 49, having missed a bunch of races, so he must be really rueing that crash that he had with, I'm trying to remember who crashed into him.
It was not Jules Cousel.
It was not Jules Cousel, no. in fact, was it De Angelis?
I think...
I mean, whoever it was, someone piled into a corner far too hot and wiped him out, didn't they? So again, someone whose season is ruined by something completely outside their control. But really, really great race. Absolutely fantastic. And very much looking forward to seeing
them. Best race of the season, best race of Moto2 that I've seen.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't have a MotoGP.com subscription, it's going to be hard to find, but really, really worth watching.
And British Eurosport will repeat all the MotoGP races until the next weekend of MotoGP racing, which is in 2 weeks, or it's not this coming weekend. We've got a weekend off, and then then we're back for Indy. So if you can obtain British Eurosport, you'll be able to watch them.
Cool.
And then we got to the Premier Class, MotoGP, and it was an interesting weekend, and we had Danny Pedrosa pretty much doing what we've seen him done, that was good England, I learned that as a children, what we've seen him do many times over the last few years, where he just takes a weekend by the scruff of the neck and dominates it, very similar to Stoner's habits at times as well. And he was, I think he was fastest in every session except possibly the wet one. But he was right on it, looked really good. Lorenzo
he was almost a second faster than everybody else after the first FP1. That's really unbelievable. Scary. It's really unbelievable.
And then we had the fly in the Honda ointment was again Lorenzo. So Pedrosa qualified on pole.
Well, before we go there, we do want to bring up the fact that we had John Hopkins was there as a wild card, and in FP3, the wet session, he had a crash. It looked pretty nasty, but kind of I think it was nasty because it was unexpected. He put his hand down poorly. and ended up breaking a finger and dislocating two others, or fracturing even them. So
yeah,
and that's his right hand. So that was his weekend ended there, and for the rest of the weekend, we were treated to seeing and hearing his broken voice. He really, 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 really wanted to be out there and was giving nonstop praise to the Suzuki, how much it has improved since the last time he's been in MotoGP. You know, it was very painful to see. Really a bummer. Really, really a bummer.
And except for Bautista, because Hopper had been been ahead of Alvaro in most of the sessions, but only just. They were generally both together, but they were pretty much, they were closer to the sharp end than they were to the Tony Elias end.
Absolutely.
Although, actually, to be fair, Tony didn't have that bad a weekend, or to the satellite Ducati end, as we could refer to it. I'd put in the show notes that Kageyama's unique 3-series point scoring record from 03 is safe, and Jules quite rightly pointed out, what are you on about? Hopper scored 6 points in Jerez. And if he had raced and come fourth, he'd have caught up with Randy Depugnier.
Oh, man.
Because they'd both be on 19 points. Now, okay, that's probably asking a lot for Hopper to come fourth. But, you know, I just looked at the points thing and thought, oh, he's only 13 points behind, and he's only raced at one weekend. That's him. Sorry, I'm not picking on Randy.
He's having a miserable, miserable year, that guy. Miserable.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely horrible. So, back qualifying. Pedrosa, Lorenzo, Stoner, front row. Spies, Simoncelli, Rossi pulling something out and getting onto the second row, which is really good. Dovizioso with his habitual, not poor qualifying, but he's not the one-lap wonder that, you know, if he could be that and maintain his racecraft, I'm sure he'd be higher in the points. Colin Edwards and Nicky Hayden completing row three.
There were two interesting things here. Casey Stoner was actually not doing very well during qualifying, and he had kind of one wonder lap, you know?
Yeah.
That put him up there, because it looked like it was going to be, you know, Spies and Simoncelli ahead of him, and certainly didn't look like he was going to have a good race. He was just struggling the entire time.
And they were mentioning on Eurosport, there was a couple of sessions, he'd come back, ride in, door slam. It was
Yeah, he didn't even complete a lap. He would go out and come back in on the same lap still, go in, spend 5 minutes with closed doors, come back out. Yep. Yeah, so they were definitely getting frustrated in there.
Yeah.
The other thing was Rossi's pace was, I mean, he's been seventh in qualifying before, but in general it's been very tough, and the gap was what was surprising. The gap was not so bad. Because it was under a second from first, and this is a very long track. So, you know, I mean, when a lap is 1 minute and 57 seconds, 56 seconds, that was boding well for him. And the interesting thing was that the changes that they were claiming, although as Julian Ryder pointed out on Twitter, he doesn't believe any of it, was that they just changed the rider position. But he's like, there were a lot of boxes that came in also.
Well, Alex Briggs tweeted, he said, oh, one of those boxes had something quite useful in it. And so everyone was then saying, can you tell us what's in it? And Twitch EP, and he was saying, no, of course I can't. Twitch EP said, all right, don't tell us what was in it. Just tell us what it said on the label. I'm not going to do that either. Right. So something has gone on that bike and made it better. But what was interesting was during QP, the Ducatis were nowhere. And then suddenly Nicky pulled out a cracking lap. And it's like, wow. And then Valentino, right near the end, pulled out a cracking lap. And it was like, wow, wow. So something happened. Unfortunately, whatever they opened, they didn't have enough to give to Pramac, because they didn't go wow, wow at any stage, really. It was another grim weekend for the Satellite Ducatis. But anyway, we got to the race.
Yes.
And Pedrosa got the whole shot, but within a couple of corners, Lorenzo had just done one of those, you know, he has the butter and the hammer thing, doesn't he? Mm-hmm. Smooth as butter.
This is the track for Lorenzo to push that, because he's really the king of corner speed.
I just eased past. It was a lovely pass. And he
started to gap him.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a little bit like Laguna when he got out front, and I was thinking, okay, could be a bit processional this. Not the person I expected to see leading the procession. But he started to get a gap out, and quite quickly we had, at the end of lap one, Danny was second, Andrea Dovizioso was third, and Casey Stoner was fourth. So again, you had the HRC 1-2-3. And God, their helmets aren't that different when you just see a flash of them. And it was quite difficult picking out who the hell was.
Oh, was HRC?
Where.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
But again, we had the. I tweeted at one point, it looked like Lorenzo was the naughty boy being chased by the HRC gang. You know, he just fired his catapult at them and was legging it up the road, and these three were coming after him. Although if you got caught by Danny, you'd probably go, hey, you know, it probably wouldn't be that scary. So by the end of lap two, Casey had got past Dovi. So we had Jorge, Danny and Casey. And then early in lap three, Pedrosa got past, and I thought, okay, here we go. He's gone.
Everybody thought that.
He immediately started pulling
a little bit of a gap, and then he crashed. But he crashed in a really strange way. In fact, he himself has said he has no idea what happened.
No,
he said the bike maybe going.
I tilted it a bit too far. Maybe the tire was quite warm. I despair of BBC commentary. He lost the back. No, Charlie, he didn't. He lost the front. You can see from every angle he lost the front. It wasn't one of those, the back comes round and unsettles the front. He lost the front. Sorry, but go back to touring cars.
It's okay. Your love affair with Charlie Cox is very entertaining.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Danny crashed out at just before they hit the hill, going downhill. So it's through the S's, T4, T5. He crashed out on T5. It's the right corners. The bike does get light there. It's also where I believe Casey crashed during one of the practice sessions, and Andrew Wheeler has this amazing photo of that crash. I'll have to put a link in the show notes because you can see him still looking through the corner as he's sliding behind the bike. The bike is bouncing.
Brilliant. Yeah,
incredible detail in the photo. Amazing, amazing photo.
But after that, and again within a couple of corners. I'm not sure if Jorge was distracted by the, wow, that's helpful. Casey got past. And despite having had, as previously mentioned, a fairly rotten weekend for Casey standards up to then, that was him. He never looked back and he held the lead right to the end and won. Although it took him a long time to completely shake off Dovi and Jorge. Danny got past and Casey got past Jorge. I can't remember if he made a mistake or if they just managed to get past. And then Danny slid out. So we had Casey, who never looked back from that point on. But he took a while. I mean, they stuck with him, both Jorge and Dovi. Stuck with him pretty close for the next couple of laps. By the end of lap 5, Dovi had got past Jorge, and we had Major GP's crazy Joe, Marco Simoncelli, who, it's got to be said, ran a really, really good race. He early on, he'd been behind Ben Spies, he got past Ben, and then he held station behind Jorge for quite a while, who at one stage where we got lap 9 got back in front of Dovi when Dovi had a little bit of a wide run. But then he got back in front within a couple of laps, and then Marco Simoncelli got past as well. And he was just putting some really smooth laps together. I'm probably just habit. I was just waiting for him to do something crazy. And he didn't.
He didn't. He was very, very controlled and very happy later on.
Yeah.
It's very important to point out, by the way, that that Jorge started struggling about 9 laps into the race because he was the only one of that, I think, the top 10 guys that actually chose to run on a soft front. Everybody else was running the super hard front.
Bautista and Lorenzo were the only soft runners, yeah.
In the entire race?
Yeah.
Wow, yeah.
It was only those two. And it did cause quite a lot of comment. Oh, and I was thinking, well, if anyone's going to get away with it, Lorenzo's famous for being the Bridgestone guy, so he preserves his tyres better than anyone else.
Yes.
But it was a lot warmer. They said the track temperature.
I don't think it was because the tyre was going off. I think it was because the tyre was just so slippery.
Yeah, it just didn't work.
It just wasn't working. It didn't have anything. He actually was saying that the track felt oily to him because it was so much warmer. And they took a kind of a gamble and then they blew it. He was very frustrated about it.
He lost the front. He lost the front on one of the right-handers and kept it up on his knee and recovered. But obviously lost a bit of time. But let's face it, I mean, Casey... coming a couple of the shots of Casey when they go back and say, oh, just check he was still there out front as he pulled away. He had a couple of real moments.
Yeah, absolutely.
Made the Honda look like the Ducati, you know, when we were used to seeing Casey riding what appeared to be a bike with oval wheels. I mean, it used to kick and buck so much. But, yeah, and I think... again, watching the proper commentary on Eurosport, Julian Riley going, oh, Casey, you're 6-7 seconds in the lead. You know, you don't want to slow down too much, but you probably don't want to push it quite that hard. And Dovi, again, with a really solid run for second and another Italian podium in their scarce season of Marco Simoncelli, finally broke his podium duck and, you know, delighted to see him up there. And he was so chuffed. And I think, you know, okay, let's not get carried away. It's a third place, but maybe he will be able to process the fact of sometimes less is more, you know.
Yeah.
Not slowly, slowly, yeah. Catchy monkey. You know, I don't have to try and win the race on the first corner. I don't actually have to win the race. I need to do as well as I can. And if that's third, then that's a lot better than DNF.
Yeah, yeah. I hope I keep worrying that he's going to go too far in that direction. But hopefully his the real Simoncelli will never go away.
No. Because we need people.
Bridgestone really need to work on the hats for just in case he has another podium finish. Because
doesn't fit, does it?
That was really ridiculous.
He needs a beach hat. I've not seen him recently, but certainly when we were at Catalonia, the years we went, there was always a guy with a massive Rossi replica papier-mâché helmet. I mean, it was huge. You could have sat several children on it. You know, it was that big. And I was thinking, we need one of those for him on the podium. Sideshow Bob.
Brilliant.
But no, absolutely. Brilliant to see him up there. Now, interesting, Lorenzo held on to fourth with Spies pretty close behind him. Less than a second at time. Even closer.
Spies, I think both the Yamahas tend to speed up during the race, whereas, you know, they don't wear the tires out. Well, Bridgestone's pretty hard to wear out. If you look at the tires in the paddock, it was a hot race, remember?
Yeah.
They even pointed it out on MotoGP.com that the only things that you could see on the tires were the pieces of rubber that they picked up. They weren't even blistered. You know,
no.
All three machines. So these tires really are ridiculously
incredible.
They can last 70 laps or something insane.
As Cal Crutchlow said, he'd rather have a tire that warmed up
exactly
quicker.
No, I think all of them.
And then he said, if it goes off, so long as it goes off predictably,
right,
and it gradually, we can manage that. And that actually that's where rider skill comes in more. He said we've been out testing. We've done 80 laps on the same tyre at as close to race pace as we can maintain. And you come back and they don't feel that much different than they did on lap 4 or 5. And you think, yeah, that's over-engineered. Maybe, I don't know. I'm not going to try and tell a tyre guy what to do other than, can you clean my windscreen at the same time, dude? But, you know, it's just, yeah, it's almost like we almost want to introduce a bit of degradation.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the World Superbike guys are always saying how they love the Pirelli because it's such a predictable wear. When they go off, they know exactly when it happens, and that's when the real fun starts. You know, that's when you see the best part of the race. That's why the racing is good to the very end, you know?
I remember Leon Haslam saying, I can tell when I get to the point where I think, okay, next lap I'll be all right. The lap after that, I'll need to back off a little bit on this corner because I can't maintain this because it will slide too much. You know, and you think, oh my God, these guys are computing this. But the feedback getting is just phenomenal. And feedback to me normally is there's gravel getting in through my neck and collar. That means I've crashed, you know. And speaking of crashing, I mean, Carol Abraham, bless him, he didn't crash. He had a mechanical DNF.
Well, I think he went off once.
Oh, yeah, that's right. He ran off, didn't he?
Yep.
Remount, he came back on, then had to retire.
So I'm guessing that something happened when he was off in the gravel. Maybe something, you know.
But he had a rotten weekend and so much pressure on him. I mean, what a nice guy. He definitely deserves to be in there. Didn't have a good time. Cal Crutchlow had gone off between Danny crashing and Carol Abraham leaving. Crashed again. You know, it's Cal again, a bit of that There's a touch of the Toslands here. Have started really promisingly, and is now it's like, come on, you need to finish some races.
That's really interesting you said, because that's exactly what I was thinking when I saw that happen. I was like, Jesus, he's the guy who kind of was dissing Toslund last year before he got into the GP. I mean, he was already signed, and yeah. He was doing that interview with Indianapolis, the Indianapolis guys. And you
yeah.
You sent me that great question where that kind of got him set off about Toslund.
Yeah.
But yeah, so he's obviously he does not consider to be in Toslund's footsteps or anything like that. Yet he's doing almost exactly the same thing. That's exactly what went through my head when I was watching that. I was like, I mean, I remember Toslund, you know, front row guitar first season, first race.
Yeah.
And then downhill.
Yeah. Yeah. And as we were saying earlier, you know, if you're going to have two halves of a season, have your bad half first half. So what people remember towards the end
exactly.
is, how haven't you come on? Yeah. Because it appears to show someone's not learning. Or they're starting to believe their own ego. I don't know. In Cal's case, I mean, he certainly, there was a load of Twitter stuff particularly from, ironically, the Brits. Going, well, you know, that's him back to World Supersport. Probably that's his natural level and blah, blah, blah. And you think, oh, for goodness sake.
You guys are very hard on your own.
We put them on a pedestal and then start throwing stones at them.
Yeah.
And you think, actually, no, he's got a two-year contract. And Hervé Poncharal has been very vocal in how impressed he's been. He's having a bad run of things. That's fine. Let's see, you know, what happens for the rest of the season. But the real one that stunk the place out for me was Bautista. He got past Hayden. He was with Rossi, and I was thinking he likes beating.
He definitely had the pace to beat Rossi.
Yeah. Oh, I think he was sizing him up, but clearly he. I don't know what happened, but again, it was a front end washout and he just slid off quite gently. He was fine. The bike obviously wasn't able to continue, but what a rotten weekend for Paul Denning, which had started so well for that team. Paul Denning, yeah. Obviously, the Crescent Suzuki owner and Rizla team manager, Rizla Suzuki team manager. But the Suzuki has definitely improved it. Although again, it's, you know, it's fast corner, warm weather, which it has always favoured. Be interesting to see how they get on when they get to Phillip Island if it's cold.
Right, right. But in general, the rest of the season is going to be probably weather that suits them.
Yeah. The only thing is, it's the power circuits, the Motegis and the Sepans don't really favour them too much. Do they? They seem to like the. Mind you, I don't know. It certainly doesn't look slow. So the result we had was the podium was Stoner, Dovizioso, Simoncelli, Demad Lorenzo. Oh, the other point I was going to make about Ben Spies. Someone tweeted, will Spies be allowed to overtake Lorenzo? Now, he didn't, but whether that's because he couldn't or he was under the impression he wouldn't be allowed to, I thought, that is an interesting point, because Lorenzo on 186 points, and now, oh God, I'm going to have to do some cross 100 maths. 32 points. So more than the race win behind Stoner, who's on 218. Dovi on 163. I mean,
this was a big bleed. This is a big bleed because Casey Stoner won the race, so he got 25, but Jorge Lorenzo only got 13 points. So right there, 12 points, gone.
Yeah.
And by the way, Ben Spies, let's not forget, he was in pain almost the entire weekend because he had...
trapped nerve?
He had some kind of a pinched nerve in his neck where he said he was eating. And all of a sudden, I mean, this has happened to me before. I think I remember like taking a helmet off and then spending the next week in agony, you know, just because something... strange happened, you know.
Oh, it's so easily
neck.
Done.
It sucks, and so he was battling through pain. So the fact that he even finished the race, not to mention that he finished in fifth place, is pretty awesome.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And he was catching Lorenzo. He was definitely catching Lorenzo. And I don't think they have team orders. I don't.
No.
I think that he, knowing what he did at Valencia, remember when he was a wild card?
And, yes.
And yeah. He was kind of like thinking, you know, I'm going to help out Colin kind of thing.
Yeah.
I have a feeling that Ben Spies knows that how important this is for Yamaha. I mean, I have a feeling. Of course he knows that. But beyond knowing that, I think he's the type of character that might just take it onto himself to help his teammate.
Well, he's got a contract for next year recently signed, so I suspect he's thinking, well, because he's such an intelligent rider, and that's absolutely clear. If he didn't have a contract for next year, it might be, I want to finish as high as I possibly can. Having a contract with Yamaha next year, he's probably thinking, I want to finish as high as I can, but maybe not battle to take more points from Jorge.
Right.
I don't know. Right. I don't know if that really plays a part. I mean, they're racers. I suppose they want to beat anyone they can. But looking at the championship standings, we've got Dovi in third. We've got Rossi still in fourth and having pulled leapfrog back past Danny Pedrosa, who obviously missed quite a few races. So I suspect Danny
And Danny didn't get any points.
And then we got Ben, 1 point behind Danny on 109, then Nicky Hayden on 103. And then we got Marco Simoncelli finally starting to claw his way up and get past Hiroshi Ayama, which before this weekend he wasn't. Colin in ninth, 1 point behind Simoncelli and Ayama in tenth. And then so on and so forth down to where we get to John Hopkins and Kosuke Akiyoshi, the wildcards this year. Anything else? Have we missed anything about the race itself?
No, I think we probably talked about it a little too long, considering that it wasn't the greatest race.
It is worth pointing out, I think, that even though I am a Lorenzo fan and known for being and was gutted for the poor little fellow, I have got Stoner and Dovi in my fantasy road race team, and I'm now 24th overall out of the 60-odd thousand who compete in it, and I'm thinking, oh, yeah.
Nice. Nice. I'm screwed because I forgot to change the last round.
There is a transfer window open now. Now for 2 weeks. So for those of you who want to tweet your teams, do you know what I was looking at? I thought the next game round, again, we've only got one World Superbike race, which is Nürburgring. I think I might just leave it as it is. I can't see Casey and Dovi struggling too much in the next few races.
Nope.
And speaking of Dovi, I've done another number crunch,
you have to compare him to Simoncelli again, don't you?
Yes, because if I was Andrea Dovizioso, and he's been quite vocal in, and I've said he possibly is becoming a bit stoner-esque in his complaints about the fact that all the media attention, all the fans' attention is on Marco Simoncelli. You're seeing loads and loads of these big Afro wigs, at various tracks. You're seeing, you know, number 58 appearing on flags. You don't see a whole load of people wearing Andrea Dovizioso replica beanies. and I kind of get that because, you know, it's not just about racing and points. It's about personality, and you develop a following and a bit of a cult status because this attracts attention and therefore sponsorship. So, and I don't for a second think that Simoncelli is cultivating anything like that. I think he's just being himself.
Of course.
And I love that. But I do understand Dovi being a bit, hang on a sec. Now, in every race except Jerez, Dovi has finished higher than he qualified, which is always the aim, I think, for races. You don't want to be a one-lap wonder. Marco has done it the other way round. Until now. This was the... you might have done it somewhere else. Nope. This was the very first race where he finished higher than he qualified, having qualified fifth and finished third. So I thought...
Well, to be fair, he also out-qualified Dovi pretty much all the time too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, Dovi's well known for not being that good at qualifier, but for having very good race pace. Marco has good race pace. He just, four times, he hasn't finished the race. Or, and one time he finished having crashed and then remounted. So I just did a little statistical exercise of, and I'll just use one example, say, like, Dovizioso in Qatar, he qualified seventh. So if he finished seventh, he'd score 9 points. So you could say he's got expected points of 9. The actual race, he finished fourth, so he got an actual points of 13. So the difference was +4. His only minus was Jerez when he ran off and finished 12th. Ran off track, came back on, and then finished 12th because everyone else had crashed, you know, below that finish. And when you add his season so far up, he's on +43 points. That's from expectation in qualifying to actual points in the race.
It's amazing. With this Brunel round, as noted here, he was 7th. So the expected points were 9, but he finished 2nd. So that's a +11 right there.
Yeah, and that's huge. So he's on +43 points. His actual points in the World Championship standings, 163. Then I looked at Marco Simoncelli, expected points to actual points, -104. And I thought, if you're a team boss, you know, and if any team bosses out there want to have a look at the incredible statistical analysis that Motor Podcast put together for you, just send a check to, but seriously, I mean, -104 points, that does not make for good reading. And you can have all the personality in the world, but, you know, number crunch some of these things. And I'm not a huge fan of over statistically and analyzing things, because sometimes it can hide truths. But sometimes it also makes you go, whoa.
Yeah. No, if you want to hammer a point about these guys, this is a very good way to illustrate that. Because until Bruno, every round, Simoncelli was a negative.
Yeah. And all but one round, Duffy was a positive.
Yeah.
Now, like you say, you could say, yeah, well, that just means Duffy's crap at qualifying. But I'm absolutely sure nobody
Look at his race finishes. If you take Jerez out, it's 4s, 2s, and 3s. Oh, and a 5th.
Yeah. Yeah, 4th, 12th at Jerez, 4th, 2nd, 3rd, 2nd, 4th, 5th, 2nd.
Yeah, whereas we got 5th DNF, 5th, which was that right through because he would have been up front.
Yeah.
6th DNF, 9th, 5th, 6th DNF, and finally the podium, 3rd, you know?
But,
yeah, I mean, you've hammered the point home.
Yes.
That's pretty awesome.
And then it wasn't over, because on Monday we had a test at Brno. We had Yamaha, Ducati, Honda there. They tested the 800s, and Ducati actually only tested the 800s. But the Yamahas and the Hondas, the factory teams, went out on the 1000s in the afternoon, and wow, all four of them broke their race weekend qualifying times,
Jorge and Spies could not stop talking about how much they were impressed with the M1, yeah. The new M1.
I mean, there was some tweets going in from Matt Burt from MCN and David Emmett, and these guys were saying, these guys are coming in grinning like the cat that got the cream. They are. I mean, Lorenzo was saying it's fantastic. The power it's got is so much more usable. We're sliding out the corners. It's just absolutely great. And Rossi has expressed surprise at how quick the Yamaha was straight out the box, saying, well, we knew Honda would be fast. That's surprising. I think we've got some work to do. That's much thinking, oh, for fuck's sake, can we? Right. Someone give us a break. But no, really positive. And you know, okay, we've had all the people saying, look, tyre technology is not going to go backwards. Electronics, we're not going to go back to the 990s. You know, the Melandri coming out of the final corner at Phillip Island with one hand in the air. But, although that was a wet race anyway, so it's kind of different. But it does look like it is going to be a noticeably different beast.
Yes. Yeah, they're definitely different than the 800s. I mean, when you think about it, we're only, I mean, we don't even know the actual capacity of these bikes. We're calling them thousands, but they don't have to be thousands, right?
No, I mean, I think, is it the HRC boss, Nakamoto, or was it Prezioso at Ducati? Someone said, well, it's between 800 and 1,000.
Right, exactly.
That's all they'll say about capacity. It's like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, really promising, but they're running out of testing time. So Valencia, which unfortunately I'm not going to be able to get to by the looks of things, Valencia test, where all the teams will have their 1,000, will have more CRTs. Oh, that was the other thing. Callio out on the CRT Suter, the Suter BMW, was within 4 seconds, just inside 4 seconds of Stoner. In fact, it was almost exactly 4 seconds. That's a lot better than 6.5.
Yeah.
Which it was at Mugello. So I think people slightly less pessimistic about the CRTs than they were. I mean, Tony
Liss. Because the other thing to remember is that the last test. Was the last test at Mugello?
Yes, I think
the,
so.
The CRT?
Yeah.
They
might. They might have been out since because they haven't got the same restrictions because it's not a current bike.
No, but what I'm saying is the last official time that when we were talking about him being like 6 seconds off pace or 7 seconds off pace.
Yes, no, that was Mugello, yeah.
Okay, because I was going to say, I wonder, because those tracks, Mugello and Brno, are about the same in length. So, you know.
Yeah, fair point. So it is quite relevant.
Right,
yeah,
because we're talking about seconds, but it's really percentages, right? We got to think of it. Yeah. But Mugello and Brno are similar in actual lap time. Now, the other thing that was interesting about testing that I wanted to point out was that I was actually thinking that Lorenzo's going to have a really, really tough time transitioning to these bigger bikes because he's never been on one.
No.
You know? In fact, the king of corner speed is going to be the one disadvantaged when everybody else is on these bikes that are a little more playful. You know, they're not going to be like the 990s, but they're going to be a little more playful. But man, he was scorching. Mm. He was fast on that.
And interestingly, him and Ben split Stoner and Pedrosa, but they were all within a couple of tenths of each other.
It's just so amazing.
That bodes well.
Yeah, you know, it does bode well.
I was going to say, if Lorenzo does do really well next year, then Valentino can't go on about how grateful he should be for having the bike that Valentino developed, because he hasn't.
The last, his last
bastion of defense.
Yeah, exactly. There was one more interesting thing, which was just how fast these bikes are going to be, because Lorenzo's speeds and Stoner, I think, also. Lorenzo and Stoner both said that it's going to be. Without a doubt, they're going to be able to hit 220 at Mugello.
And Rossi has commented on that and said that's not the problem. The top speed doesn't make them dangerous.
No, exactly.
And he said, in the electronics are just as good as the 800s, and the tyres will be just as good. And then someone said, unless we eat them.
Mm.
So it'll be interesting to see how Bridgestone work with them, because they must be getting. They must be thinking, yeah, this testing ban or the testing restrictions are pain for us as well.
Yeah.
They had Tim Tremaine, is it? They're one of the Bridgestone guys in the box with them at Eurosport. And he said the only true test for a tyre is a race. So you can test all you like and we can talk about race pace and race simulations, he said. But they don't get put under the same pressures they do in an actual race.
Absolutely. I mean, that goes for the bikes too, right?
Yeah. I mean, when you're testing, you're staying on the same line pretty much all the time.
Yeah.
You know, like, unless someone's dawdling in front of you or whatever. But, you know.
You don't get to think out of motivation. You know,
no,
the motivation during a race is completely different.
But don't you love the way when we do have a testing weekend, people look at the times as if they're racing each other? It's like, nah, it's about testing different bits and all that.
Right. Because one of the things was Rossi's times were much, much slower than during the race. And they were just running the 800s. They weren't running the 1,000. And
yeah.
But that's because he was working on something else. So he claims, anyway. So coming up, we've got Nürburgring and World Superbikes, one of my favorite tracks to watch superbike racing at.
But not for another 2 weeks this weekend.
Nothing going on this weekend.
A long, long break.
Yeah, yeah, very long. I think 5 weeks.
Yeah. God, they must be getting stir crazy.
And then Indy, which is a round that I'm going to be attending, and then Jim, unfortunately, is not going to be attending, so it's just going to be me. We'll do a meetup. We'll do next show. Next week's show, we'll have specifics, but I can tell you right now, almost definitely is going to be noon on Saturday in front of the pagoda on the yard of bricks. So
yeah, and don't, like last year's, bring in hammers and chisels and try and take souvenirs away. Apparently they get really unhappy.
we'll make sure that there's other good people there to meet, because otherwise you're just be coming out for me.
Do we want to mention VSB in the showdown phase, or should we leave that for next?
You know what? Do you know what this exact rules? So please explain them to me.
Okay, BSB did a whole swathe of rule changes a couple of years ago to make it more relevant. They've just done another one, and I'm sure people are aware they've banned traction control for next year, which will be interesting. In fact, you guys were talking about it last week. The showdown thing, this came as a result of the Leon Camier BSB Championship two seasons ago, which was a runaway, and they wanted to avoid it happening again. So they said, right, what's going to happen is, if anyone looks at the BSB website, the official BSB website, they will see that on the point scoring, on the championship table, the top six are in a slightly different colour. I'm trying to think, how many meets are there? 16, I think, possibly 18. However many there are, the last three are what is now called a showdown. So at the end of the last race weekend, before those last three meets, one of which is a three race meet at Brands, the points kind of stop, and the top six get broken off into their separate championship end game, if you like. Their points so far become irrelevant. What they get is they all start on 500 points plus. They get podium points, 3 points for every first place, 2 for every second, 1 for every third. So, you know, if someone's, you do have some point differential between them. Okay. And then they compete with each other with standard race points being allocated for the next three, for the final three rounds. Everyone else basically are just there to make up numbers at that stage. And they're racing for a ride next year, and possibly they're riding to help their teammate who is in the top six if they can. And this is totally separate from the Evo thing. Don't get confused with the Evo championships. Just, it's like BSB's CRT. So they're running completely separately, but everyone's on the track at the same time.
Well, except that the CRTs are probably not going to have an official,
No, I don't. In fact, I was going to mention that earlier. I wonder if they will have a little cup for the winner at the top CRT. I don't think they will.
For sure. No, they're definitely not going to, because I think that would hurt it's still a small grid, but I'm sure that, you know, there's going to be a lot of competition between
the end of the year
teams.
They might have rookie of the year and poor person's team of the year. I mean, CRT of the year. You don't know. But that's the BSB thing. And it was all designed to keep the championship alive to the end of the season. Now, of course, what happened last year is everybody looked at what the points would have been if they'd had a normal season, and who actually won it. And of course it was Chiannari won it last year, and he would have done anyway. So actually it didn't make that much difference. And it just happened that it was a season that would have been really close down to the wire anyway. It was just what they tried to avoid. The year before, Leon Camus just ran away with it on the Ducati and wasn't seen again. It was,
so it's really interesting, because there's all these rules in BSB, and now they're saying let's take away traction control next year, for example, right? That's the thing that they're talking about, but why? They're very preemptive about it, which is cool. I like the fact that they're thinking ahead, right? There's a lot of series that chase the results, which is the absolute worst thing you could possibly do. right?
I would like to see their qualifying system introduced into World Superbikes, where your fastest lap on race one decides your grid position for race two, which means you can overcome a bad qualifying. However, the last meet, that brought up a bit of a issue when Shaky Byrne, having put the wrong tyres on, it was a drying track and or a wetting track, coming which way round. He came in, changed tyres, so he was a lap down, and he went past Gary Mason, who was fighting for a podium. Now, when Shaky Byrne goes past you, you just presume, well, that's me back to fourth. So Gary Mason pushed really, really hard to get past Shaky, not aware that, you know, Shaky was a lap behind him. Reason Shaky was going that pace was to get a really good lap
in. Exactly.
To qualify well for race two. So that is the only time. And there was a bit of a spat afterwards, but I think it all calmed down. And Gary Mason didn't crash.
Is there really anything wrong with that? I mean...
Well, no.
It's dangerous. I guess you could say it's dangerous because if you're...
Well, Gary Mason's point was he was pushing it so hard he nearly lost the front a couple of times, desperately trying to get his first podium of the season, whereas, in fact, he wasn't at any risk of not getting his first podium of the season because Shaky was a lap behind.
Exactly. I was just going to say his team could have showed
Shaky
him.
Minus one lap or something.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, if he'd have looked at it at that stage, I don't know. So anyway, that's the showdown.
Interesting.
And the reason that BSB are doing this is we've still got teams pulling out. We've had Loris Baz lost his personal sponsorship, so he got dropped by Motorpoint Yamaha, Rob McElney's team, because they couldn't afford to keep him on. We've seen GSE Racing, who was so successful with Colin Wilson over the last few years with multiple championships, they dropped out for this year. And yet, I mean, Snetterton had 45,000 fans turned up. You know, in a country our size, for a national series, that's pretty good. That's although amazing. It has to be said, Bernot, 155,000.
Yeah.
Woof.
Yeah.
That's got to be the biggest of the year.
But well, so far, definitely.
Yeah.
Oh, what'd you get
in Indy?
What was Jerez? Indy? No, we get Indy. They never released the numbers, but I think the numbers we heard from 2008 was around 90,000. And then based on how much less people are there, I'm guessing it's around 60,000. Laguna fills up. And Laguna this year was incredible. I mean, it was packed. I don't remember it being that packed since 2006.
That's very encouraging.
It was really good. It was really, really encouraging. And 155,000 at Brno, but Brno is really a huge circuit. It can take it, and it's in a great area that is kind of missing. I think there's a lot of motorsport fans around it that don't have anywhere else to go. It's the next closest place is like the Saxon Ring, you know.
Yeah,
which also gets a really big crowd considering how tiny the place is.
I mean, stadiums like Valencia can only take a very finite. That there are only so many seats.
Yep.
You know, you've got a couple of grass banks, but you don't have that much. You know, I suppose Assen might challenge it in numbers. A lot go to Assen. Catalonia, I mean, we saw 130,000 first year we went, 120, and then we think last year was probably much closer to 100. So they were dropping quite remarkably.
Yeah.
And, of course, Qatar don't get very many. In fact, someone pointed out
it was there were more booty.
Fans. Yeah, there were more fans at the Brno test than there were at the Qatar race. Yeah.
It's amazing. Amazing. I do like the fact that we go to Qatar. I like the fact that all these different kinds of passions, because you know that people who go to Qatar to watch the race are, you know, pretty serious fans.
Yeah.
You know.
Or their corporate guests who are like, hey, we're doing what now? What's this?
Sure, I'll just go out there and watch some guys race quite fast.
Yeah.
Okay, we better wrap it up.
Yeah.
Did you want to talk about this history?
Well,
all
I was going to say, and it was particularly because it's you and me doing the show, is I was, because the football season has been off for the last couple of months, and there's a couple of very entertaining podcasts I listen to.
I guess you don't watch the Women's World Cup then.
Not
that
really.
That was quite interesting, actually.
Yeah, no, the standards have improved massively, except for goalkeepers who are rubbish.
Yeah.
Don't know what it is, why girls can't do goalkeeping, but they are pants. Sorry, girls. They're better than I am, but then, you know, maybe they're just not tall enough. They need to bring in some basketball players. Yeah, no, but I was casting around for podcasts, and I'm a very keen student of history, and particularly one of the areas I've often concentrated on was Rome. And I came across a chap called Mike Duncan and his podcast, The History of Rome, which you can find via iTunes or at thehistoryofrome.typepad.com. Now, and he immediately, I started listening to it, and I thought, oh, he's an American guy, I can deal with the accent, I'm pretty used to it now. He's you. He has your voice. He's got a really laconic, or maybe languid might be the better word, delivery, with a brilliant dry sense of humor. And bearing in mind that I've learned how difficult it is to do these when there's two of us talking. And these are he's there's 147 episodes so far, with a few more to come. If anyone is a history buff, they're in 15 to 20 minute episodes, but they are just really illuminating. He cuts through all the crap, and but he just I just thought he's actually from
Well,
Portland, Oregon.
that's what Bob. That's what you
Yeah.
know. That's what Bob did for a long time by himself. You know, these 20-minute
Yeah.
podcasts, and somehow he was
And
able to do it.
it's not easy, but if anyone is interested in it, you know, and sometimes you find you've got a commute and there's nothing good on the radio and you just need someone to back it up, you know, absolutely brilliant. Really, really impressed with it. And you
Cool.
should listen now, Jules, because you want to hear someone who sounds like you.
It's kind of scary.
No, he is, but he has some great lines, like, you know, they said, well, the Gauls were suspicious of Julius Caesar's motivation in delaying them in case he, you know, summoned more troops and built a massive wall. And when they came back to visit him again, they found that he'd summoned more troops and built a massive wall. You know, he's got a wonderfully sarcastic, and not sarcastic, that's too strong, just a very good
Sardonic.
delivery. Sardonic, absolutely. Thank you. Yes. Damn, it's my language, and I didn't know it.
Your language?
Yeah,
Okay. Do
you
I
guys borrowed it.
have to pay royalties?
Oh, would you? That'd be handy.
Yeah,
Just send a check to the
you
same
bet.
place that that all these statisticians are going to send them to. No, we're the statisticians, team managers. Anyway, I'm waffling now.
All right. Well, Martin, it was really great to have you back on the show. I
Yeah,
think
it's
everybody's
great to
missed
be.
you. I've missed you big time. And
Absolutely. I've missed everybody.
so we'll hopefully be talking to you very soon.
Well,
And I
yeah,
don't know what
we've
we're going to be
got
talking about next week, because really it's going to be hard
the
to
Indie
talk.
Show.
I guess so. Which is, you know, it's not exactly an exciting track, so it's not like much of a pre-show. We'll
We
see.
could
We'll
get Mike
see.
Duncan on board to do a history of motorcycle racing. All right, dude.
All right, let's end this.
Fantastic.
All right.
Everybody, keep your emails and tweets coming.
Have a great day. I'm going to go to bed.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go back because I'm hungover from last night.
Right on.
I'm going to get
Excellent.
back to bed.
Excellent.
All right,
Excellent.
brilliant.
Ciao.
Cheers, everybody.